This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The ongoing battle between acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey and Dennis White, the police commissioner she's attempting to fire, has become kind of a standard bearer for how cities can and can't move forward on police reform and police oversight. Now, we've been following this story closely here on Radio Boston, and the legal battle went two more rounds in the last 24 hours, with results that kind of telegraph where we might be going on this. WBUR's Allie Jar Manning's here to catch us up. Allie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so Allie, this is gnarly. We know there are a few big picture legal gray areas, whether Mayor Janey was justified in trying to fire the commissioner, whether the mayor has the power as acting mayor to fire the commissioner. So Dennis White had asked a judge to basically say, you may continue serving and not be fired while these legal questions get sorted out. He also asked for a hearing where he would be able to call witnesses and try to clear his name. We got a ruling from the Superior Court judge on this request to stop things from White yesterday. What did the judge say?
Yeah, so in short, she said the city can move forward with firing White. She says White can always pursue monetary damages going forward if he thinks the firing was improper. But she did put a hold on her order today while White appeals it. So that's going to slow down his expected firing.
So she made a ruling yesterday and then today suspended her own ruling because he's appealing yesterday's ruling. Is that right?
Yes, he's appealed it to a single justice of the state appeals court. So we need to wait for that justice to say, yes, he does have a case, this can go forward, or no, I'm going to just affirm what the lower court judge said. So as you said, it's gnarly. So what the judge did not do at all in her decision was wade into any of the political questions that have been swirling around White's firing, like whether former Mayor Marty Walsh knew about the domestic violence allegations against White when Walsh tapped him for the post in January.
Okay, so the places where White is pushing back, one is this appeal to the decision from yesterday, but he's saying some other stuff too. Tell us about that.
Yes. So to get a little nerdy about the city charter for a minute, Janey is required to hold a hearing before she fires White. The Janey administration says this has to be very informal. Basically, here, we're going to fire you. He has a chance to, you know, defend himself, but not a big drawn out thing. And typically those are done behind closed doors. But White wants that hearing to be public. He's calling it a trial-like name-clearing hearing. And he wants the city to bring forward the witnesses they're relying on to justify his firing, and he wants to be able to cross-examine them. And so here's what White's attorney, Nick Carter, said about this during last week's court hearing.
The level of defamation that has taken place here is so extraordinary that Dennis White needs to and is entitled to a robust hearing while he's still commissioner, when the public is still paying attention, to say to the public, here's what really went on.
Okay, and for the record, I am all for getting nerdy about the city charter. That's good stuff. All right, so acting Mayor Janey must have something to say in response.
Yeah, so yesterday, after the decision was issued, Janey issued a statement saying she'd schedule a new hearing with White pretty quickly. Now, of course, that's on hold because of White's appeal and stay. Janey says, though, it's time to move the city and police department forward, and that echoes what the city's lawyer, Kay Hodge, said at the hearing last week. Let's take a listen to that.
Boston deserves a police department that is consistent with Mayor Janey's vision of integrity and accountability. It has to move forward.
Okay, so Allie, help our listeners remember, Mayor Janey decided to terminate White, his employment, after the release of an investigative report that dug into allegations against him from the 90s. Remind us what the big takeaways from that investigative report were.
Right. And so this goes back to before Mayor Janey actually took office. This was under the Walsh administration. So This was triggered by a Boston Globe report that detailed domestic abuse allegations against White levied by his estranged wife in the late 90s. And so then Mayor Marty Walsh brought in this outside investigator. The outside investigator also uncovered an earlier altercation with White's 19-year-old niece in 1993. White was accused of punching her and throwing her down the stairs. In both those cases, the police department did investigate at the time and cleared White, and White denies the accusation. Now and then. Janie has said, though, the behavior that White admitted to is enough to terminate him. She said he wasn't cooperative during this recent outside investigation either.
So, Allie, as we said at the top, to some extent, lots of cities and towns are going to be watching this because it has to do with how American execute oversight over the head of police. So you've been covering this. What are you going to watch most closely from this point forward?
Yeah, so I'm interested to see how this latest appeal goes, of course, but I'm also really curious to see if White gets his way to have the hearing public in some shape or form. And I should say that this city charter is unique to Boston. It differs in other cities and towns about whether you can fire or how you hire the police department. So it's kind of a weird, very Massachusetts idiosyncratic thing that we have here. But really, this is all part of a much bigger issue of what's happening with the Boston Police Department. The department has, you know, really been beset by scandals. It doesn't have a permanent leader in place, and it's supposed to be enacting all these reforms that we've yet to see any real movement on. So I'm wondering how much is the scandal and the legal limbo going to delay or halt any of the promises that have been made over the last year? And really, what kind of difference will that make for people affected by policing in Boston?
All right. WBUR's Allie Jarmanning. Allie, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to turn now to the legal pieces of this and get a little clarity with Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back.
Good to be back.
So thank you for coming. Allie just gave us the rundown on what's happening. Did anything jump out to you from what you just heard from a legal perspective?
Well, I was not surprised by the judge's decision yesterday saying that she would not intervene to stop White's termination, because she had to make a determination about whether he was irreparably harmed by not being in the police commissioner job. And it's hard to say that he would be irreparably harmed. It's not like he's losing his position on the force. He's losing a prestigious command. So that wasn't a surprise. And she also said that she didn't think that there was a likelihood of success on the merits, which is legal language for essentially looking at the facts now. She doesn't think that he has a likely winnable claim. And the ambiguity of the legal issues are really part of that. This is a 1962 statute under which White is proceeding that calls for a notice and a hearing. It doesn't describe what it has to consist of, and there is no case law under it. So the judge fairly says, I can't say you're likely to succeed. We're all on new territory here.
Okay, so the underlying I'd love question to stop you there. So just two questions there. One, you said no irreparable harm. From the cut that Allie played for us, it sounds like White's attorney is arguing that there is severe reputational harm and that should count. Am I understanding that correctly? And does that count?
Well, his reputational harm comes from his having been dismissed. And if there was a legitimacy to the dismissal, then the reputational harm comes with the territory. In other words, if I fired you from your wonderful position, which I never would do, and I was right to fire you, you're harmed by it, but it would be legitimate. So the underlying question here is whether or not it was legitimate to fire him. That's the underlying question. And for that, he wants a hearing that would be public. And again, we're dealing in a very gray area. There are rules about hearings when you dismiss a police officer. There's civil service rules. There are collective bargaining agreements. But with respect to a police commissioner, there really are no rules. And the statute says notice and hearing. Mayor Janey says, I'll give you a hearing, the content of which will be determined by me. There's no law regarding it one way or another. His reputational damage is troubling. There's no question about it here. But that's all tied up in whether it was legitimate to fire him or not. That's all tied up in the legitimacy of this report.
Will we likely see another legal battle come out over what happens in the hearing? So you've just laid out, it's not really codified, not really clear what does or doesn't have to happen in the hearing. Mayor Janey says what has to happen in that hearing is whatever I want. White's attorney says what we want in that hearing are witnesses to testify publicly, a chance to cross-examine, clear his name. Is there going to be more fighting in the courts? I mean, is this going to drag out for a really long time?
Well, my prediction here is that the Supreme Judicial Court will do exactly what the Superior Court judge did and deny any preliminary injunction, which means the court would say, I'm not going to intervene, let this proceed as it is. If there's an issue here, if there was a mistake about the kind of hearing, then there will be damages after the fact. But right now, I'm not going to stop his termination. You know, there's an irony here, which is the White case began with an internal affairs investigation of the accusations made by his wife against him. That, of course, was completely confidential. Nobody had any problem with that being confidential. And so the counter to that, the investigation that was produced just recently, which came up with another accusation of violence and a more elaborate description of what the issue was with his wife, was essentially an investigation on the same terms that all the other investigations have been. And White didn't object when he was exonerated by the Internal Affairs Department and to the way it was done. Now he's objecting because it's become public. There's a little bit of a double standard there. I doubt very much if the mayor will make this an open hearing.
So one of the other questions that I wanted to ask you, the acting mayor, Mayor Janey, has made it very clear, it seems, that her intent is to fire him after the hearing. Now, if one's supposed to have some sort of evidentiary hearing, but the person holding the hearing has said in advance what the conclusion of that hearing is going to be. Is that legally a problem?
Again, there's a whole continuum. Let me sort of use an even more nerdy word. There's a continuum, right? The blue ribbon hearing is a trial with witnesses, appeal, et cetera. But there are all sorts of informal hearings that are short of that, that take place under different kinds of circumstances. And what Mayor Janey is saying is that typically this is an informal proceeding at which witnesses may or may not be sworn, but at least the proceeding is confidential. The law doesn't tell us where we are in that continuum. It really doesn't. There are reasons to keep it confidential, which is there may have been people who came forward against White, who came forward on the condition of confidentiality. Now, they actually have no entitlement to confidentiality if the truth is told. On the other hand, as I said, these proceedings are usually done informally. There's no answer here. I wish I could give you an answer, but there really isn't an answer. There are reasons to make it public so that he could clear his name. On the other hand, the witnesses who testified on the condition of confidentiality may be troubled. It really could go either way.
The team is telling me a statement's coming from Mayor Kim Janey on the injunction ruling for Dennis White. I'm just going to read it. I respect Judge, and I'm afraid I don't know how to pronounce the judge's last name, Brieger's decision to review her ruling, and as such, I have postponed the hearing for Dennis White. I stand ready to move forward on behalf of the residents of Boston and the Boston Police Department as soon as the court allows. I am grateful for the continued professionalism and service of our BPD officers during this time. So last question then. Should Acting Mayor Janey be able to do what she ultimately wants to do, which is fire the commissioner? The city charter, we're getting our geek on in all kinds of ways today, comes back into play and says that acting mayors, quote, shall possess the powers of mayor only in matters of not admitting of delay, but shall have no power to make permanent appointments, end quote. If you fire someone, you've got to put someone else in their place. Can she hire a replacement?
Well, she could, we're in the gray area. She could hire another acting person. And arguably, this is an issue that does not admit of delay, right? There has to be leadership in this department, particularly at this time. Let me back off again. So there's a hearing issue, and if she is wrong about the hearing or wrong about the ultimate outcome here, then White will get damages for his for the ways in which he was damaged. But will he get the job? Should he get the job? In my view, not. But that's just one person's view.
All right. Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst. Thanks. We're going to talk cannabis now. What Boston, other cities and towns, and the Commonwealth do now will determine whether the decision to legalize marijuana builds an industry that is rich in black and brown business ownership, which was part of the intent in making the legalization decision. There are a couple of proposals on the table in Boston to change how the city does business with the business of cannabis, and they underscore the issue. Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards is pushing for reforms in licensing. Joins us now, Councilor Edwards. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So I want to mostly focus here, Counselor, on the Boston Zoning Board of Appeal. You want to move the Zoning Board of Appeal out of the licensing process for cannabis businesses. I know this sounds dry, probably to our listeners, but it turns out it's a pretty big deal. Why do you want to do this?
Well, just to be clear, they don't grant licensing and they're not part of the licensing process, say, for any of our alcohol establishments. I just want consistency. And I want the new board that will be, I think, a year old in June to be able to function. And what's happening is people are, establishments are getting licenses after community meetings, after going back and forth, after adjusting their security plans, after doing traffic studies, and they go back to the community and they're getting the license from the board and then going in front of the ZBA, and the ZBA with no standards, no real understanding, I think, of the cannabis law or the equity program is deciding yes or no as to whether that entity can go to the state or not. And there's no real clarification as to why they make their decisions.
I'm just going to pause you there for a second. So there is the Boston Cannabis Board. It makes a decision, but then there's this step that you would like to see eliminated where the Boston Zoning Board of Appeal also makes a decision, correct?
The Boston Zoning, yes, Board of Appeal, and their decisions predominantly deal with the fact that this is a conditional license in commercial areas. And I would just want to make it a conditional use. And I just want to make it an allowable use in a commercial building or entity or, you know, wherever it's zoned. And that's it. And that would get rid of the ZBA. I think the ZBA has backlogged. It has a lot of cases on its own right now. It's dealing with enough issues and trying to enforce the zoning laws on the books. This was thrown on them. And before we even had the cannabis board, we now have a board of experts picked based off of their understanding of security and traffic and equity and public safety and health and workers' rights. That board can do this job. And that's all right, I'm saying. That's it.
I want to play a little bit of sound here from Kobe Evans. We talked to him earlier today, co-owner of Pure Oasis, which is a cannabis business in the Grove Hall area, talking about how this change could help.
It's a great idea. I guess the hard part is, why didn't someone think about this earlier? It would have been helpful because then you don't have to spend the extra month or two presenting in front of the cannabis board. And for every month that you are waiting in this pipeline, you're spending money. So if you can remove any of those requirements along the way, that's an attorney I don't have to pay, rent I don't have to pay.
He estimated something like this could have saved his business about $40,000. So two questions coming out of this. The first, why is this proposal only happening now? And second, are you confident that the delay issues would be eliminated if this goes through?
So why I think I explained the reason why it's happening now is we didn't have a cannabis board when we first started. We had just the ZBA and the Office of Emerging Industries. Okay. And then the yep. board itself just started really hearing and working in June, July of last year. And so I think after a year of seeing it work and getting the licenses and denying some licenses and then making people come back and do all the work, we've watched the board move, grow, and create an efficient process to get or to not get a license. And we're there now, a year later. And I think, you know, we will always come up with additional regulations and different standards, but the ZBA no longer is necessary.
That's so now the need is clear. So now the need is clear and there's an alternative that's possible is what you're arguing.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. And I do, I want to, so we've talked about, you know, sort of, I'm thinking the phrase from the old children's show, confusion and delay, but there's also, it sounds like an element of capriciousness that is a concern here. I want to bring up a story from back in 2019. We spoke to you about the debacle over two cannabis stores in East Boston. They were Berkshire Roots and East Boston Bloom. They came to the ZBA, one applicant before the other, and the first one got approved. And then because the first one got approved, happened to be earlier in the agenda, the second one didn't. So would a problem like that be eliminated if only the Boston Cannabis Board were in this process? Or would, because that was about siting that caused the second one not to get approved because it would have been too close to the first one. So talk about that.
Yes, that exact example is one of the inspirations for that, for this particular zoning amendment, is the fact that where you stand in line shouldn't be the ultimate determinant of whether you get to have a business or not. I also would like to note, you know, there's so much tension between what they now consider themselves each other's competition because they might be too close to each other. And I know some entities want to keep the ZBA involved because they're first in line and they will absolutely use the buffer zone to kill their competition. That's a misuse. I want to go back to why we have this buffer zone. Forget why we have the ZBA. Why do we have the buffer zone? The buffer zone was to prevent a concentration of cannabis stores in any particular neighborhood. That's it. Nothing to do with traffic, nothing to do with equity, nothing to do with competition. We just didn't want any one neighborhood to have all of the cannabis stores.
And so to be clear, you've proposed new regulations that would give the cannabis board power to grant exceptions to that half-mile buffer zone. You want to reduce that or have the option of reducing it, correct?
I want them to be, I want to be clear that half-mile buffer zone will exist. And there will be times where the cannabis board says, we won't be given an exception to this. It doesn't make any sense to do that. And there may be times, for example, in the East Boston, where we're talking about maybe 100 feet difference, right? We were not talking about like very close to the other entity. We were talking about maybe 100 feet out of the half mile buffer zone, two different sections of East Boston. And that's what was used to kill that, the competition. So I think that those arguments should be able to be made to the board, and the community will be able to come in and say, absolutely not, we disagree. I am not saying the conversation shouldn't happen. I just don't think after a long back and forth conversation at the Boston Cannabis Board, the ZBA can come in and say, yeah, okay, or no, you don't.
So one of the pushbacks to this proposal is, in fact, concern from some that the ZBA listens to community in a way that and pushback in a way that potentially the Boston Cannabis Board would not. The ZBA is made up of representatives from a bunch of different industries that make up the city. They have a process for listening to the community. What do you say to that pushback?
I'm trying my best not to laugh. If you have heard anything about the ZBA, that they reflect community need, want, and desire, it's laughable the amount of reforms that are being thrown at the ZBA because they grant variances like candy on everything apparently but cannabis. It is laughable that someone is actually saying that they are more consistent in hearing community than anybody. The outrage that I have from the ZBA and how they literally do the exact opposite of what the community shows up to advocate for, it's laughable.
Is there something structural that you think needs to happen differently when equity is at the core of an emerging industry, basically?
I think we are doing that.
What I'm asking you is this in part, these changes, are they in part because, I mean, we have an unusual situation here in the Commonwealth in that the legalization of marijuana from the get-go was expressly stated in part to be done in a way that would improve equity, right some of the wrongs of our previous criminalization, and create an industry rich in black and brown owned businesses. Is this forcing a looking at, there's a whole lot of different ways we need to just do business differently if that's the goal?
Well, So this is not the goal of adding to that conversation in terms of equity. If at anything, we have built in other structural things that are pending, including the fact that we want dispensaries to have the 1-for-1 ratio. We want to maintain that, but we don't want it to be a dispensary and say a delivery that is compared as a 1-to-1, because we felt that was going to be lopsided and allow for a lot of non-equity corporate entities to be able to use a delivery, which, as you know, the state has allocated the first licenses to equity applicants. We didn't want them to use deliveries, equity applicants, as their ability to get the 1-for-1 ratio. So in short, we are looking at and seeing how systems could be lopsided, and we're trying our best to make sure that we are always centered in equity. But this is about consistency. This is about efficiency. This is about making, you know, I don't know a rational business out there that says, after I've gone through all this and paid all these lawyers, that I want more bureaucracy. I think it's time that we really acknowledge the ZBA no longer has a role, space, or need in this conversation anymore.
And that is Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards. Councilor, I appreciate you taking the time today. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, so the first holiday weekend in our new normal is this weekend, just around the corner. So we want to know, Greater Boston, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go? If you need ideas, we have just the thing for you. We have two guests who know the city inside and out, from fake Vikings, and there's such a thing, to a sneaker store hidden behind a vending machine. Heather Kaplow and Kim Windica are two local travel writers, the authors of the new book, 111 Places in Boston That You Must Not Miss, and headline, they're not all in Boston. Heather, Kim, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you have a sneaky favorite hidden spot around the city or the region that you want to share? Do you have questions about oddities that you think your guests might know? Maybe you're looking for advice on where to go. Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, I am excited to dig in. This book is chock full of really cool stuff. Right off the top, one of my favorite things is the fake Viking memorials. Heather, who knew we had that? Tell us about them.
Well, I will say that I did not know that we had that, but actually WBUR did, and you guys, I should give a shout out, were one of my research resources in this. So a writer or a journalist named Megan McGinnis wrote a piece about this.
Megan McGinnis.
Yeah, 2018. And I used a lot of different resources, but that was one of them, and I feel like I should give credit where credit is due. But
she's going to appreciate that.
So there are a series of memorials to a fake alternative history, I guess, that Boston has, which was sort of started in the 1870s, where some very wealthy folk, including a baking soda magnate, underwrote an entire series of monuments, a tower in Weston, Mass. But in Boston, we have a statue of Leif Erikson on the Commonwealth Mall. And in Cambridge, a marker for a house where Leif Erikson supposedly lived in 1000 AD.
But didn't.
Didn't at all.
Okay. So, Kim, let me turn to you for a minute, because I'm looking at the book. It's page 197. There's this picture of a cod. I got the biggest kick out of this, the sacred cod at the State House. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so actually this one was also Heather that she wrote the chapter, so she can speak to it more than me specifically.
So I'm Heather, do you want to, or do you, Kim, do you want to tell us about one of yours?
Yeah, sorry. So one of my favorite ones actually is the Puppet Free Library, which is—
Oh yeah, this chapter, one's very cool.
Yeah, chapter 90 in the book. It's a kind of hidden tribute to the lost art of puppetry. It's actually in the basement of Emmanuel Church in Back Bay, and it's run by a puppeteer named Sarah Peedy, who she actually trained and performed with Bread and Puppet Theater, if you've heard of them. You basically go through an Alice in Wonderland-like door, as I mentioned in the chapter, and it's by appointment only, since it kind of doubles as her studio. And for several years, she had an informal practice of kind of lending out puppets to people in the community to use them for events, which she still does today, but she kind of formalized the process of signing them in and out, hence the name Library. So they're used, you know, in parades like Honk Fest throughout the year. And some of them are just huge, 20 feet tall, and just really cool to see.
All right, let's go to the phones. 1-800-423-8255 to either ask a question about your favorite regional hidden place or share an idea. We're all going out somewhere, or not all of us, but many will this weekend and step outside and try something new. What do you recommend they try? We've got Ann on the line. Ann, I think you're in the car in Foxborough, right?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I just would recommend it's outside the city, but a wonderful place to visit that a lot of people I don't think know about is the Fruitlands Museum and the whole complex in Harvard, Massachusetts. It's a wonderful place for people to visit.
So it's a museum and open space, Anne, is that right?
Yes. Yes, it is. And it has a Shaker Museum as well as the Fruitlands themselves was a utopian community that was started by Louisa May Alcott's father and some of the other transcendentalists. And it's a really nice place to have a picnic, and they used to have concerts. I'm not sure with COVID if they still have concerts.
Right. Right. Thanks for the recommendation, Anne. I appreciate it. Now, there are more calls coming in. We'll go back to them. But, Heather, I still think that cod is really cool. So now that we've heard about the Puppet Museum, which was on my list, let's come back and talk about the sacred cod at the State House.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about this. This was sort of a weird oddity that I really had no idea about. You know, this, I'm super excited to find out about it. So I guess Boston, like other places in the world, but the cod fishery is like critically important to Boston's culture, Massachusetts culture in general. And so there is a giant, like more than 4 foot long, I guess maybe probably almost 5 foot long wooden codfish, like very super hyper realistically painted, hanging in the house chamber in the Massachusetts State House. And it's not the first one, the one that's there now. There have been like an official cod since 1784. And the cod itself, like each cod has had some kind of major trial to get us to the current cod, including one that was burned down and one that was codnapped by the Harvard Lampoon folks, who are also in our book. The Charles River was dragged in search of that one before it was returned. And there's
did
also
they get
like
into
a lot
trouble?
Of, I don't know. I'm assuming they did. The police dragged the whole Charles River. So, but I think the most important or interesting thing to me about this is that there are a ton of rituals surrounding this. So like when the cods had to be moved from one place to another, there's a sergeant at arms carries it. It's escorted with messengers, like a coffin with an American flag over it. And there's a ton of like legislative paperwork and committees who talk about how this symbol's to be moved. So I think it's really just a beautiful thing that we've decided to put like the labor of fisher folk first
in
this
awesome.
Ritualistic way.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255 to share your hidden and favorite place. Let's talk to Andrew in Brookline. Andrew, what you got?
Well, there's a secret garden in Harvard Yard behind Lamont Library. And the only way to get to it, you know how Harvard Yard is surrounded with these brick and wrought iron walls? There's a door. A piece of the wrought iron is hinged, and you can't really see it unless you look closely, and it's usually padlocked, but sometimes it's not. And if you hinge that open, there's a little path that takes you back to this garden behind the library. And I'm told that Mark Halperin, the author of Winter's Tale, when he was an undergraduate at Harvard, used to sit back there and write. It was a place he could find some peace and quiet.
Well, that sounds lovely. And these are the fun things to go look for. Andrew, thank you for that call. So Heather and Kim, another one that I just found fascinating, and I don't know which one of you wrote this one, so you can tell me and talk about it. Who's going to tell me about the bodega? Because that was kind of incredible.
Yeah, so bodega is basically a sneaker speakeasy. And it's also, you know, a secret kind of passageway. I love kind of secret and hidden places. So I was definitely drawn to them when when researching for the book. So it's basically a convenience store facade, though you can purchase convenience store items there, and you go through a fake Snapple vending machine to get to this super curated, really cool sneaker shop. They have no signage. It's all really word of mouth advertising they've relied on. And they've been there, I believe, let's see, probably close to like 15 or 16 years now. And even if you're not, you know, a sneakerhead or super into sneakers, it's definitely worth checking out.
So I was going to ask you, I mean, I noticed in the book, the only picture we get is of the bodega part, not the secret part behind the fake Snapple vending machine. If secretivity, right, is part of their cachet, were they okay? I guess they must have been okay with being in the book, but I thought that was a little bit interesting.
Yeah, that's true. Our photographer Alyssa kind of worked her magic with a lot of the places that, you know, aren't necessarily typically accessible to the public right away to get some of these shots, which was also really interesting. So I'm not sure what transpired or if they, you know, didn't want her to get back there for the shot, but I think that's part of the fun.
So listeners, we're talking about secret places, hidden places, surprising places down secret passageways. But maybe this weekend, you're just going to go back to one of your favorite places. Maybe it's the Ducklings. Maybe it's the Swan Boats. Maybe it's a park in Lexington or Concord. Where are you going to go this weekend? Where do you think other people ought to go? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. That's the number. So you guys talk about... now the Omni Parker House, which was the historic Parker House Hotel, which really has a deep history. I knew a little bit about it, but you surprised me with some pretty famous revolutionaries who have been on the staff there over the years. Talk a little bit about that one.
Yeah, this one falls in my pile again. I've had some pretty close contact with the Omni Parker House in the past, and this still took me into depths that I had no idea. Starting, I think, in terms of revolutionaries, in 1911, Ho Chi Minh worked in the kitchen there and, left behind a marble countertop that's still used to this day.
I'm sorry, but we have to stop. I'm sorry. Ho Chi Minh cooked in the kitchen of the Omni Parker House.
Yep.
Incredible. Sorry, I'm sorry, what?
It's amazing. And then we also had Malcolm X did a little bit of a stint there as a busboy. And then a lot of famous chefs and writers have spent some time there. Plus, there's a few ghosts.
Ghosts. Okay. Don't stop after the word ghosts. You have to tell us a little more about that.
Well, the most prominent ghost is Harvey Parker, who founded the hotel. And actually, he's a very kitchen focused person. So who's in the kitchen does matter in the culture of this hotel, I think. But and also, I should say that the Omni Parker House is the longest continuously operating hotel in the country. Because I don't know if people know that, but
I don't think so.
It was founded by Harvey Parker, who is famous for the Parker House rolls. It's also the place where the Boston cream pie was invented. And he had once had a cafe, and then he turned it into a hotel. And apparently, he still checks in on guests on the 10th floor to make sure that they're comfortable and happy and enjoying their stay. Charles Dickens apparently roams the halls from time to time too.
Yes, and Dickens actually, WBUR, we do a reading of the Christmas Carol every year. He did a reading there, and there is a mirror in a hallway there that supposedly is the one where he would practice when he was going to do a reading. It really is quite incredible.
Yeah,
let's take another call
reading of
here.
The Christmas Carol was there. Sorry.
Right.
I think the mirror is there now. Yeah. So there's just a lot of Dickens lore floating around that area.
So cool. 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. Peter's got a place to share. Peter's calling from Weston. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi there. I've tried this place. It's really great. It's called Bed and Breakfast Afloat. It's a place to stay on the harbor in a boat.
Sort
of cool. Yes.
It's almost a Seuss rhyme.
It's at Constitution Marina, and it's just a fun way to spend a weekend.
There you go. So what about the other kinds of things we like to do on the weekend, Heather and Kim, like eat out or see a movie? Do you have favorite places for those things in this book?
We do have the specifically the midnight showings at the Coolidge Corner Theater, which just reopened, I believe, last week or the week prior. And, you know, that's one of my favorite places to see a movie personally, just the history there. And the, you know, the shot in the book we have of one of the theaters is just gorgeous. So that's one of my favorites.
How about food?
Go ahead.
No, go.
I would say for movies, it's not quite the season for it yet, but Films at the Gate in Chinatown is sort of a really special way to see a movie. And they haven't done it since 2019 because of COVID, but it's been going on since 2006, I think. And it was founded by a group who's no longer based in Boston, but the Asian Community Development Center still runs it. And it's curated by an amazing, historian of both film and martial arts. So there are kung fu films, and you bring a folding chair and everybody eats like takeout food while they watch the films and scream along and, you know, like clap for the heroes. It's a completely unique way to see a film.
It sounds fantastic and so communal. And isn't that remarkable that we've been so separated now for more than a year, and we're beginning to be able to think about having some of these communal experiences again. Let's go back to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. Andy's calling. Andy, you're calling from Boston Harbor area yourself. Tell us what you want to share.
There are two places. One is outside of Boston. It's in Rockport. It's the Paper House. The entire house, which was built, I think, around 1920 or so, was made by rolled and shellacked paper. The owner of the house was an engineer. If everything is made out of paper, including the piano, the grandfather clock, all the furniture inside, the exterior, everything is made out of paper. And the house is still there. It was closed during the pandemic, but, I mean, I went there as a kid with my parents, and I bring friends there all the time when they come to the city.
And this is Rockport.
That's in Rockport. It's on Pigeon Cove in Rockport, Cove Road. And the second one is the Vilna Shul, which is the oldest still standing synagogue in the city of Boston. It's right on Phillips Street in Beacon Hill. And it's part museum and part working synagogue still. But it's on this residential street in this beautiful neighborhood. And it's just a little tucked away, but it's a gem. And the museum part of it tells the whole history of the West End, which at one time had as many as 40 synagogues in it. And the Vilna is the only one still standing.
Thanks for those, Andy. Those are hidden gems as well. Andy, thanks for the call. I'm going to grab another call here from Sarah in Jamaica Plain because it has to do with the Parker House. Sarah, go ahead. Sarah, are you
Maybe
there?
Maybe not, but yeah. Can you hear me?
Okay. Now I can.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, this may have been mentioned already because I came late into the story, but maybe not when you're talking about the Parker House. But there's also in the dining room, I don't know if it's haunted or not, but I don't think they let people sit there, a corner table where JFK actually proposed to Jackie, who became Jackie Kennedy. And that's where he proposed to her.
All right. Thanks,
table.
Sarah.
Yep.
Heather and Kim, you guys have something to say about that, right?
Yeah, there's a little bit of controversy about this issue. There is also a restaurant in D.C. that claims that this is where this proposal was made. So, and we've dug pretty deeply into the archives and the microfiche at the JFK Kennedy Library, and we have been unable to ascertain which is true. And then there's also a third theory, which seems also very plausible based on just the timeline of the news reporting, which is that the proposal happened by phone or telegram while Jacqueline was in, I believe, Rhode Island with her family.
I think it was Newport,
Rhode Island. Yeah, with her family. So,
we can't prove that one, but we can go ahead and claim provenance in the region at the very least. DC can be second in row.
I mean, they had many, many, many meals at that table. So,
excellent. So, Sarah, if you're still there, does that change your mind about how cool that table is to know that that's actually a story in dispute?
No, because even if he didn't do it there, it's more than likely that they had dinner there at some point. So, you know, whether you did the proposal there or not, who cares? It's significant. There are a lot of, you know, significant sites in Boston, obviously, have to do with the Kennedys. So, you know.
Excellent.
Hey, I'll take it.
I love the DC, who cares.
Which, yeah, I think if it was D.C., that's maybe more than likely, because she was working as a reporter when she originally met him. That's how she met him. She was doing an interview. But, you know, it was some time before he proposed to her, and she was actually engaged to somebody else. She broke her engagement in order to marry him. So, yeah.
Well, Sarah, thanks. Thanks. So I want to note Marquise Neal, our engineer, and Paris Alston, one of our producers, want to throw in their favorite spot, which is the Area 4 Arcade in the back of Roxy's on Mass Ave in Cambridge between Kendall and Central Square. It's a great place to check out. And Walter Wuthman, another one of our producers, says, swim off the pier at the Charlestown Navy Yard on a really hot day. He says it's fantastic, and the harbor is very clean now. All right, so Heather and Kim, any place that didn't make it, you wanted to put it in the book, but for one reason or another, you didn't?
Yeah, for me, that's actually Norman B. Leventhal Park in Post Office Square in the Financial District. It's just such an oasis in the middle of the city. And when I work downtown, I used to go there frequently. You know, there's a beautiful covered trellis and a fountain, and it just feels kind of worlds away from the city. And I was really kind of sad to have to part with that. But I think we probably had too many parks and green spaces in the book already.
So Heather, what about you? What's yours?
I mean, I have so many, but we weren't able to include the Mirabella Pool, which is a city pool, a city owned pool that has this beautiful, it's in the North End, and it's got a beautiful view of the Atlantic Ocean. It kind of juts out over it. And, you know, very, very cheap to get a membership, very cheap to go with a day pass. And it was under construction, and we didn't know the final completion date at the time of publication, so we had to scrap it. And but it's a beautiful place, and I hope people look for it and swim in it this summer.
All right. So before we let you go, there's one more that I just have to ask about. We've got about a minute left, and it is the memorial, or lack thereof, depending on how you look at it, to King Philip's War.
Yeah, this was a risk we took, I think, to include a few sites that aren't quite places. But I think this is important because, you know, the colonial history of Boston also includes some colonialism that oppressed and harmed many other people. So King Philip led a rebellion in the Boston area and was assassinated. It was a year plus long rebellion, was assassinated and kind of drawn and quartered, and parts of his body were hung on spikes in Boston Common for many, many years. So there's a movement to have a memorial for him. There is actually a gravestone for him in Rhode Island, but there's a movement to have a memorial for him in Boston Common. And for now, we send people to a spot where a lot of other Native Americans were hung to sort of reflect on the history until there's a formal memorial. So,
and to note, he was a member of the Wampanoag tribe.
Right. Which a lot
All right,
of
well, so many rich and interesting and fun and serious places. Heather Kaplow, Kim Windica, authors of the new book, 111 Places in Boston That You Must Not Miss. And you convinced me on all 111 of them. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
That was fun. All right, listeners, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.